Cool, thank you. All right, so we talked about performance. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things PT5 brings that make building these switch web applications a little easier. The main thing we did years and years ago when we started PT5 was we looked at how XML would have handled PHP4 and stuff. It's really, really hard to write XML parsers in PHP4. We wanted to fix that. Part of the problem was back in the 90s, there weren't that many good XML parsers up there. There weren't XML parsing libraries that were very good. There's XPath. LibXML 2 was damn shaky. But then over the years, LibXML 2 really, really got better. Daniel Bayard and his team have done a really, really good job on LibXML 2. And it's the fastest speed-based parser that we've come across anyway. There are a few others that we've been playing with, but as a general purpose XML parsing library, I think it's the best one out there. So we based all our XML parsing on LibXML 2. Everything revolves around the DOM document. So if you do new DOM document, load menu XML. That gives you a DOM tree in memory. So a few things you can do with that. Here's a menu. An XML file is a breakfast menu. Five food items. Each food item has a name, a price, a description, calories associated with it. So to parse that in different ways. First of all, we can do an XPath on it. So DOM document load, you can just load the XML as a static method call on the DOM document object. So we load in one operation here, and we now have a DOM string for the menu. We can start up a DOM XPath object and run an XPath query. If you've never seen XPath before, you're lucky. I think it's done. But for some reason you like XPath, note that if you do use XPath, it's going to light up like a Christmas tree on call rank. That's going to be a bottleneck, I guarantee you, unless you have another user group in your face somewhere. It's very handy. So in this case, I'm setting up an XPath query that says, give me all the nodes under the breakfast menu, give me all the food nodes whose item number is greater than 3, and give me the price as a text string. Give me a break on the format of this query. That's XPath. We didn't come up with it. And that comes back and gives you those two nodes, 450 and 695. That's the price for all the items whose item number is greater than 3, right? So 415, 695. So it's sort of like doing SQL on an XML file. So the other thing you can do XSL. So you can apply a file sheet to your XML file. A file sheet is just XML as well. So you load in your menu, you load in your file sheet, you start up the XSL preprocessor, import the file sheet, and call one of the transform functions. Normally, transform through another XML file. So transform to XML. And my output here, my file sheet just applies some HTML markup for each of my menu. It's really ugly, my file sheet, but you can see that that's what it is. And again, XSL is not fast. They're always speeded up by caching the compiled file sheet containers, and that's not going to get stuck completely. But it's still pretty damn expensive to do transformation. The main thing that came out of this new XML implementation, PHP5, was simple XML. This thing is nice, but you load in an XML file and it becomes a PHP object at that point. You can then navigate through it as if it was a series of nested objects and processes. So we loaded our reference menu. We loop through all our food items. Any attribute on a node becomes like an array, associated to the array element on that particular object. Any subnodes obviously become children of that object. So you can really just redirect the null file and write your code without worrying about parsing it. You read it and say, I want to loop through all my food items, the menu food as items. For each item, I want to print out the item number attribute, and then I want the subnode item price, item name. And this is the item, right? So item number, price, 3 dots, and the name. Not a whole lot of code. You take that XML file and turn it into something that looks a whole lot better on your web page. You don't have to think about it. That's the most important part of this thing. You can also use something like printr
once you build it in, it dumps out the entire object to see what's in there. To make it a little bit easier, so we look at that object structure and print out the right pieces that shows you about so that was just a fast summary of that. Some of the things that lets you do a one-line RSS parser, Atom parser, I know it's another thing that they're using. I don't care. That's the other thing about simple XML. You don't really have to care what format stuff is in. You just write some code that that prints out what's in the structure. So in this case, this is basically a one-liner if I could fit that URL right in here. So it's going to slide. But simple XML load file, that long URL, this is the Flickr upload queue. So these are the photos that were just uploaded. If I reload it, this will change. So these are the photos that were just uploaded to Flickr, and there's a feed, an XML feed of these photos, and you just have to print out the entry content node, which is a little blurb of HTML that you can then put into your own site. And yeah, you never know what is uploaded. Always interesting to show what it's like. So here's an Atom parser that does a little bit more markup on it. This connects to Google Group, especially the PHP name, comp.name PHP usenet group. So here's the URL for the feed. Load it up. And then we can just start printing out the pieces of the feed that we want. So there's a title and a subtitle as a top level node, or one level feed, I suppose. And then we move these to our entry, print out the date, and then I have a big tear doc, which is mostly just HTML. Just a few things in here. I have entry author's name, entry link, intra, entry summary, date, which I did a little bit of calculation on here to get it into a format that I like. And this is the output. Lots of stupid PhD questions here, but the important part is that this is, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 lines of PHP code plus a big care doc, just with your swap of HTML to actually show it. But in total, this is maybe 15 lines, and it's a decent little interface to a usenet group somewhere that you could put in the sidebar of your application or whatever. But this is only possible because it's so easy to parse XML now. You don't have to think about it. Just load it in and you're done. Now, to build a rich web application, you basically just need to consume rich data from places. One of my favorites is geocoding things. So Yahoo is who I happen to work for, but we make no money off of these APIs, I'm showing you. So I don't care what you do. I'm just saying that geocoding is cool. And you can put in a rich URL here. You can go into the apilocal.com map service v1 geocode, put whatever app ID you want. We don't care. We don't actually need to check. And you put a location. There are a few other formats that you can provide this in, but you can do just a straight location. And if it's a city that's somewhat unique on the globe, you don't have to put anything else in there. You can just say location for city. And this is what you get back. Right? You get the Latin along, which is the important bit. You also get a few more information, like the state and the country. If you put a full address in here, we'll try to geocode the full address, and you'll get better precision. In this case, it's also the precision that you give you, a great city, but you gave a city name, that's what's accurate. Parsing is pretty easy, right? I can toss it into simple XML and pick out the right thing, and I can get into a PHP array like that. Be a little bit careful if you don't provide a decently lucky location. In this case, I put in 701st Sunnyvale, which isn't a complete address. It came back and said I couldn't find that exact address here, so it's matched, and it gave me that. So your code should probably check to see if there was a link in there. Just so you don't go off and start off and do what you want to expect. So from that, you can combine the geocoding lookup with Flickr searches. Flickr is now geocoding people's photos, or you geocode your own photos when you upload them by putting them on a map basically. And here's for the PHP code. It looks really complicated, and it is, because I had to break out my grade 10 algebra figure out how to map a square to a sphere, basically. So I wanted to take a point on the globe, and then I wanted to sort of draw a box 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers, and I want to see all the photos that are taken in this 100 square kilometer area centered on this spot on the globe. I'm sure there's a library for that, but I just didn't, it's not that hard to do that. It's like four lines of math here, right? So a little bit of math to do it, and I found this bug because you guys are in the Southern Hemisphere, damn it. So my code wasn't working because you have to put the bounding box in with the minimum and maximum, and I can flip because of the negative sign, so I keep bugging out next to it. But, so in this case, it ran for 50. And the cool thing I think about this one is that I didn't put in a tag, I didn't put in 50, I didn't put in any text, I only put in coordinates, because please find me all the photos taking these coordinates. And if you go through, you can see that list, and you get to the opera house, to the bridge. Usually when I show this at conferences, you end up with lots of conference photos, the geeks tend to steal those things. But I don't see any specific conference photos. There's too many people taking photos and didn't have it. Yeah. But, I mean, you can put in anything. So, you can put in no. Think a little bit. Now we have pictures taken from Melbourne. Does it look like it?
Anything you need to know from Melbourne?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so it's right. That's good. That's good. Even people in Perth take pictures. Not bad. An interesting way to combine different web services, you can do some very cool things. You can really spruce up your application. And some of these bits get people motivated and to contribute. And by sort of reaching off other people's web services, you can build a site that does a lot more. It looks like it does a lot more than the amount of work you actually put into it. You combine a few things like that, you write 200 lines of PHP code, you can do some really interesting stuff. But, few hints. Try to avoid paying your users, for example. Participation gimmicks of various kinds. They never prove to work. They don't scale. If you really do hit something, and you get millions and millions of users, and you're paying something equivalent to a dollar each, So it's usually not a good idea. Try to get the rock sources going. Sort of get in and get their primal instincts and get their hormones flowing. Somehow make it addictive. It's actually all. I mean, you may just be putting a front end on some university service where you don't necessarily care that it's addictive as long as it's useful. But if you're trying to build a startup and you're trying to build an actual business out of things, the number of eyeballs tends to be important. The number of people using the service and how long they spend on your site is very important. I work for Yahoo. That's some of the main things we think about is, how do we build services that are useful enough to people that they'll keep coming back and they'll spend lots of time on the site, they'll get their friends involved. A recent one was Answers by Yahoo. I don't understand why it's so bloody popular, but Answers by Yahoo has hit this addictiveness thing somehow. I think it's our third try of building something like Answers where people come and post stupid questions and get stupid answers. But for some reason it works. Millions and millions of people are using this site because you somehow got the equation right. We make the site fun enough, and we have a little bit of sort of incentive where you get answers to points, which mean absolutely nothing. But if you get points, you can have more points than somebody else, right? So that's somehow motivating, and that's what it looks like, right? You go in, you can search for questions, so you can search for PHP questions. That's always fun. What kind of questions people are asking about the issue. PhD my career. Yeah, okay. So, and of course, you can then talk ads up. And search is one of the best places for that because people are actually looking for something. Putting ads in your email is not very effective because if you just go and check your email, it's not that it's not an easy step to then go and say, I'm mad. If you're reading an email from your mother, you're not looking for something. You're mostly probably trying to avoid your mother. But it's not a good place for ads. But when you're looking for answers to something, it's usually a really good place for ads. And other places like shopping sites, it's a great place for ads because people actually go to buy stuff. Anyway, so you want to try to find that right little trick that gets people on all these things. The UI is extremely important. Make it very clean and intuitive. Web 2.0 seems to say it means big font. Web 2.0 font. Just make font sizes big. Think of a little bit more intuitive than that. But try to make a nice clean interface. Big things. Make this site only do one thing. You can't build the site because it's 12 different things. People get confused. Yahoo answers the question. Either ask the question, we answer a question, or you look around. So those are the three things you can do on the site, which is all around asking and answering questions. And don't get too complicated. People don't like complicated. Flickr is not that complicated either. Nice sort of simplistic UI. That's a little bit on my home page here. But it's not that hard to figure out. It's a little bit more on the geeky side. But some of the things you can do appeal more to geek. If you look at Yahoo's two photo services, we have photo services and Flickr. Everyone in here has heard about Flickr. You probably all use Flickr. I bet very few of you use photos at Yahoo. But photos at Yahoo is the order of magnitude more legal than Flickr, which is strange, but there's a lot of soccer moms out there that are terrified that other people can see photos of their kids. They don't want to put their photos on Flickr. So there's sort of two very distinct separate communities. The soccer moms that just want to share photos with her sister somewhere and nobody else should be able to see them versus the geeks that sort of get this whole interacting around things and taking photos and commenting on other people's photos and stuff like that. And that's a very, very special and distinct group. And you have to understand which group are you targeting or maybe you target both. Well, you have to get into two different services. And everyone asks, well, why the hell do you have two photo services? Because the customer is completely different. Anyway, not really weird. APIs, use them. Don't just leech APIs, but expose APIs as well. If you become the de facto place for something, Flickr has a whole bunch of APIs, for example. Anything you can do in the Flickr UI, you can do via the API. So you can build your entire own front end for Flickr if you wanted to. It does everything Flickr does. Because everything that Flickr can do is expose via an API. And Flickr has now been integrated into all kinds of stuff. You go and read a blog somewhere, you'll see Flickr photos on the blog. All kinds of things you can do via the Flickr API. That only helps Flickr. It helps that website that instead of you building your own photo mechanism somewhere into your application, you just sort of reach out to Flickr and say, okay, well, if you want photos on the blog, so just upload them to Flickr, connect them, and then look at photos in the blog. And the blog doctor doesn't need to implement this whole photo mechanism. And if you can become that standard for where people do something, you've got made. So don't be afraid of exposing things via API. It'll be helpful in the end. I'm trying to make the stupid thing work. You can have the best idea in the world and the best API, but if the thing crashes every 3 requests or it's slow or you're able to do time, people are going to go away. So do some profiling, do some benchmarking. And what happens next? Alright, so the last section is security. Any questions on the previous section before I go to security?
Yes. The work on benchmarking on the web application, is it a collaboration? Does it actually be another anything?
Yeah, there's a flag on APC though that can do that. Or, I mean, if you're running this thing locally, you can turn off authentication while you're profiling. I mean, don't profile a benchmark on your live web server. Have a development server, someone on your development network. And yeah, turn off some of those things.
There's another question?
There's nothing different. So the question was any way of seeing up Ajax requests. I mean, the request itself is up to the browser, right? So presumably you mean the response to the Ajax request.
And as far as Webster was concerned, the Ajax request was just like a normally key request. It is normally a key request. So the exact same thing applies. So whatever that Ajax request is sending, you can figure out that URL, and you can put that into your Ajax and reload it, and simply optimize the hell out of those requests. The fact that they're coming from JavaScript really doesn't matter to me versus someone typing in that same URL.
Use the for each, then, isn't that? Use that actually a copy of the array before it actually went through it. Can you still do that, or?
PHP uses copy on write. So the fact that it makes a copy doesn't mean it actually makes a copy. It means if you were to change something, it would make a copy. And since you tend to not change the array that you're iterating through, you don't have to worry about whether a copy is made or not, because it's not.
Well, from a performance perspective, you can always say, you know, if you
don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It'll do the right thing. And, I mean, if that's your bottleneck, you've done a really, really good job. I bet you, if you've done profiling, if you profile yourself, PHP script execution is nowhere near your bottleneck. The things you talk to, usually, that profile is just a PHP script. Yeah, I mean, then you can start trying to optimize on yourself, but even a tiny change like that would be really hard to measure. If you don't script execution, I'd say you're done on optimizing that one. Feel for not. Alright, security. This is one of the things that PHP has gotten slammed on recently. And every time someone says, well, I'm using PHP, people start saying, why the hell are you using PHP as insecure? There's nothing inherently insecure about PHP. We have had a few security problems, like real security problems that we would no more, no less than most other open source projects. Less than a lot, actually. What we haven't done a great job of doing is teaching people that input filtering is important. That you can't just take whatever the user sends you and echo it back. Now, we have realized that we need to provide some tools for people to make that easier. And we've always had functions like HTML special child and others that will do the filtering directly. But you have to remember to call them. If the user doesn't call them, well, it's very easy to write them into your application. At the same time, people hate magic things like magic codes, for example, that automatically fix them. Finding a balance between sort of hand-holding people through security versus going too far in either direction doing absolutely nothing to help them and just saying, hey, so you need to filter your input versus filtering everything, really, really, really hard. And the unique situation to PHP with is that there's a lot of people without very much experience using PHP because they couldn't figure out the other one either. Right? So our audience is somewhat unique. And it's not that people can't figure out other languages. Obviously, I'm going to have a lot of folks like that. I use PHP, and I can actually figure out Perl and Python and Ruby. I still prefer PHP because it's a lot faster to talk about the web application than PHP. And yes, it's now easier building large complex functions than PHP and other applications, other than the fact that I can get new developers up and running PHP way, way faster than I can the other languages. I have 6,000 engineers doing PHP work, Yahoo has 6,000 or so. Well, probably not all. We have thousands anyway, of Yahoo doing stuff with PHP. If I had to go out and hire just 100 Ruby developers, where the hell do I find them? I would then teach Ruby to 100 people, that's going to take me a while. But I can get 100 people off in production with PHP pretty damn fast. And if I provide them with a bit of guidance and this is how we build a PHP application, it's not that hard to get a team of developers up and running and productive using PHP. And that's why we're using the team we provide. So what do we do about security? First of all, what's the common security problem that you guys have? And this is it. Process. Correct. So we have a form like this, name and age. I hit submit.
up pops the thing that shows me my cookie. And then it still does the right thing. Now, this is because there's actually no input validation here. There's a form that gets some data, and we print that user data directly back to the web page. So we can put any JavaScript we want into the input, and it's going to be printed out right back to that user. And then this is called a context cookie. Now, the way you can fix that is that you can make sure that if you're asking for somebody, it's got to get a So anything that comes across in the browser, browsers don't have types, right? Everything comes across as a string. You have to apply some typing on your end if you know something should be a number. So for the age thing, you can simply pass it to an integer, which is an effective way of filtering out anything that's not a number. For the name, we can encode anything that's special to an HTML page. So it's no special chart for that for it. So there's a third one a lot of people miss called HTML. Itself is the URL of this particular page, and that URL can contain JavaScript. So if you're printing that exact URL back for some reason, in case it's not an action back on the same thing, you need to escape that as well. So now we can do exactly the same thing here. It works, and we don't get the JavaScript pop up. So this is effectively a safe application. But it's only safe because I remember. The problem is people don't always remember the Google stuff. Here's my LPA badge. Text there, come over here. Nobody else at the company has that text. I'm sure. Now, I don't know why the LPA registration has this silly thing, the sentence that we put on the badges. But for some reason, it generates this string that ends up in the batch, right? And you can't pick your own, it just generates it for you with some algorithm, right? Now, obviously, that's not an important thing, but for some reason, they do this. Now, I was able to change this because they have no check that the form that you're filling in is actually the one that gets posted to the page that receives the form data. So I took that form, put it on my own machine locally, changed around completely, and the hidden field that has the string in the form, I just changed that hidden field. And then I posted it from my machine to the LPA web server, and then I could put anything I want on my badge.
Well,
there was a point to it. The way you fix a problem like this is by something called a crunch. And the crunch depends a little bit on what you're doing and how you're doing it. Now, if you wanted to make sure that the hidden fields on your form couldn't be applied by the user, you would take those hidden fields and basically add a signature with some secret word as well. You have some secret, you have the hidden field, you might even take the username, because you log in, when you're doing this registration, you log in and you're filling out the form, so you actually log in to the site this time. So you take the username of the person who logged in, that you take the hidden field, you add a secret word to it, you hash the whole thing up using MD5 or SHA-1 or something, and then you have this crumb that you put on that particular form. Now, if I then take this form and put it onto my own machine, and I change one of those three fields, I have no idea what to do with that crumb. So this is some big crumb, which might be an MD5 checksum or a SHA-1 thing. Now, I have no idea how to regenerate it because I don't know the secret word. So if I then post this form to the server, that form will then obviously check the prompt. But it's going to go through and say, okay, I take the hidden field, add those things up, put them all, concatenate them together, put the secret, put the username, MD5 or SHA-1 in, compare that sum against the one in the form that's submitted. If the two don't match, then somebody's done something tricky. Right? They changed one of the hidden fields. They've done something. They're not coming at the same user that the initial form was shown to, for example. But it's not really that I can change my own thing. Sometimes that's important, but most commonly, where people put up like a login or something, they put up a fake page that then posts fake information as somebody else, basically. So they can trick people into doing things like buying stuff or selling stuff, whatever. So if it's really important for some reason that the form matches the form receiver, you should put a crumb in on the important piece of information in there. that would stop. That would stop these kind of two things that happen. The site also has some exercise problems, but they fix it.
How are you using registers on those things?
Well, I do. I do. I mean, I refuse to register. I check the site for cross-site scripting problems, and I send an email to the organizer saying, please fix your cross-site scripting. And I won't register, I'll show up and review. And I do that every year. There's a new cross-site scripting every single year on this site. And it's hard. I mean, this stuff is not easy. Even people who know a lot about it will make mistakes. So, while you're at it, watch out for SQL injections. So if you're putting things into an SQL query, you can use PBO, like I showed earlier, where you can use name parameters as placeholders. So PBO is a colon calibrated, colon color, and then when you do the actual execution, you can fill in the values for it at that point, and those values will be escaped. Be careful, though, that you don't put values directly into your SQL here, because some people then also have like the table name might be a variable, right? Or limit some number. Say you have number of results per page, right? And people can say, I want 20 results per page, I want 10 results per page, and that results per page ends up writing a limit query. There's no prepare execute replacement that will fix that. If you don't filter that limit, then people can redirect things right into it. And lots of sites, if they had anything like number of results per page, try putting a single quote and some other extra directly in that number, and you'll be surprised how many of these that actually works for the inject section. So, SQL injection is bad. Shell injection is probably worse. Obviously, if you're doing anything for system calls, and you're letting user data straight through to a system call, you're going to have problems, because people can try to concatenate other commands onto individual calls themselves. So be very, very careful. There's a PCP call called escape shellers that can help you escape shellers, the things that happen right in the shell command. But try to avoid system calls altogether. Definitely avoid system calls that have any sort of use data. Shouldn't be that. So, very, very common problems when you're going through a website. The 404 page will typically show, sorry, couldn't find blah. And they show the actual URL that didn't work. I don't know why. You don't need to show that URL for the minimum 404 pages to do that. And you just put some JavaScript in the URL, boom, you run JavaScript on that stuff. Search pages. Sorry, couldn't find, here are your results for blah. They always show the search term on the search results page. Often that's not searchable. PC self and PC applications, people sometimes forget to filter that. Obviously, PCs do get post cookie data, stuff that's coming from the user has to be filtered. Many of the server components need to be filtered, and I'll talk more about that next slide. And then very close, you have to work around. Apache has a problem with the spec header, the extended spec header to Apache. It has its own version of a 404 page for the spec header. And that's the cross-site scripting problem. So if you're running an old version of Apache older than about 4 months, you have to upgrade it, or you have to come to a certain level. And then countless problems in IE. So char set detection specifically in IE, arbitrary header injection, post header spoofing, request splitting, all kinds of problems with IE. And talk a little bit about it. So, the two main ones, or two recent ones that have really crippled the web from a security perspective. So the first one is an ability to remotely spoof arbitrary request headers. So by remotely spoofing, I mean I, as the bad guy, can tell your browser to send any request headers I want to the site over there. So I can control your browser to send any headers I want. Now, that combined with some other ones is fatal, basically. So if you're running IE with Flash Inc, you're dead. I can basically sit down at the machine and do whatever I want on your browser with your browser credentials against any site that you're logged into or that you have credentials against. And I do this by doing something like this. Here's one that basically breaks virtual hosting in every way. So in this case, the arbitrary head-on sending is a host header. So I build a little Flash movie somewhere, and if you happen to browse around and you hit a piece of Flash somewhere, I can run my code, because Flash runs on your browser. This Flash animation can tell the browser to send a request to host.foo.com, but also send a host header of host.example.com. So IB will say, okay, I have a plugin that asks me to connect to host.foo.com. Fine. So look at my cookie jar and my ACP authentication credentials, attach all this to the request, and we're ready to send the request now. But oh, by the way, let's also add a host header of host.example.com afterwards. Now the request goes out. The problem is, when this request comes in on host.foo.com, which is what IE connected to, it did a DNS lookup on host.foo.com, and it got an IP. So it sent port 80 on that IP, it sent in host header, host.example.com, with all the credentials and the authentication of host.foo.com. So if you have two different websites sharing the same IP, you have absolutely no security. There's no way of not leaking your cookies or your ACP authentication credentials from one domain to another on any virtually hosted, name-based virtually hosted domain. So all the ISPs when you're sharing IPs, if you have any sort of authentication or login stuff, forget it. Right? Anybody will be able to trick somebody into doing things with those credentials, or just simply stealing those credentials by redirecting that stuff to any other site on that same ISP. And the bad guy might simply sign off on an account and get it as a name on that IP, or if there are, say, 200 domains hosted on that IP, all you need is to find one of those 200 domains with a suffix with the whole line. And believe me, if there are 200 websites, I can find a cross-site scripting code on probably 180 out of those 200. Finding one, you need another problem. So basically, virtual hosting is broken. Until everybody else stops using IE or upgrades to Flash 9, there's no way to protect against this, because at the server side, you cannot detect it. You have no idea that this request came in, that the initial DNS lookup was host.foo.com, because it can connect to the IP on port 80 and send the host header. We don't know that IE did the wrong thing before the request went up. We sent the wrong cookies and the wrong ACP up to that request. We can't fix it. We have to wait for Microsoft to deliver it. So that's pretty discouraging. So the second one, we've got macro building screwing up the engine. This is the PDF problem, which I'm sure you probably care at all about it. Basically, the Acrobat Reader plugin is full of holes. Now, an easy one, if you're serving up any sort of PDF from your domain, then somebody can construct a URL that looks like this. Send a large pool of PDF and synthesize a fragment in here with some JavaScript. Now, if you happen to click on that URL somewhere, even in your email, like an image, it might be pretty easy to trick someone into actually going to a URL. The request comes to you on your server, santa.org, for foo.pdf, because the fragment doesn't go across the wire. That just tells the client where in the page it should scroll to, basically, and the PDF document where it should move to. But the Acrobat Reader will execute the JavaScript with your cookies, for example.org. So again, it's something you cannot fix from the server side. There's nothing to filter it because the stuff didn't come across the wire. You can't filter it. It will simply execute JavaScript on your domain. In essence, it's not on your domain, but it's in your browser with the credentials of your domain. So it's a full-on cross-site scripting code that you cannot filter it. You're simply screwed. You cannot serve up PDF. If you have authentication, the cookies, anything on your site you want to protect, not so about the you can force them to be downloaded or something like this. This only affects IE, Windows, PDF, Acrobat Reader, 307 or under, something like that, 306 or under. I forget. To protect yourself, simply update to the latest Acrobat plugin if you're actually using it. To protect your users, that common top that no real way around it, or move all your PDFs off of your machine. Now, well, that's done. What's stopped even harder is that this same problem can be applied locally. So, if you embed a URL like this into a site and trick people into clicking on it, so here's a file, blah, 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 and Acrobat Reader, by default, comes with this PDF file in utex.pdf. So everybody who's installed Acrobat Reader has this local file. So we can trigger this bug locally, and we can run any JavaScript we want locally if we can trick someone into loading that particular URL. And people click on links all the time, right? They don't look at what's behind the link before they click on it. So it's really easy to get people to click on links. If I can run local JavaScript, I can do anything I want. I can take any local file, make a backend request, send it somewhere, right? Local JavaScript can do all kinds of work. And it's quite interesting. Now, Firefox has some protection that limits the scope of what local JavaScript can do, except if you embed it into a media file, like this. So if you put it into like an AVI, an MP3 file or something, then you can get around that problem in Firefox. So basically, if you download into a media file like this that has this embedded trick in here, again, even on Firefox, I can run local JavaScript if you have this stupid Acrobat Reader install. These are non-fixable problems. You can't, from a website developer perspective, you cannot protect your users from this. There's nothing you can do service side to fix it. You just have to wait for people to stop making sure that there's something in my project.
Just to clarify, the consequence is you're talking to you and you just get a part of the
right. So
the third time you get the credential.
So the local exploit here doesn't really have a consequence against your website. Now the first one does because it's your credential. It's this sense that, and I actually probably didn't really show why this hurts. Cross-site scripting can do all kinds of interesting things. Cross-site scripting really means I can sit down on your browser and I have all your cookies, I have all your credentials, and I can do anything I want against that particular domain. So if I can run cross-site scripting JavaScript against a specific domain, like this first example, nothing to do here, then if you're logged into your Yahoo Mail, for example, I can delete your mail, I can. Well, what most people like to do is spammers anyway. They can grab your address book. Right? They grab your address book, add that to their list of spam addresses that they can ban. Other people can steal accounts that way. There's all kinds of interesting things that they do. Or there are people that run services that basically say, I will hack your Yahoo account for $50. Or I'll hack anybody's Yahoo account for $50. They're not really hacking the account. It's more sort of social engineering that they get people to click on the phishing page, for example, or they get people to type their Yahoo password into some other page. And it's really hard to prevent people from typing their password into a page that looks like Yahoo but isn't. Now, we fixed all the cross-site scripting problems that we know of. There's always going to be some here or there. If the phishing page is actually hosted by you, if you're on example.org and your phishing page is on example.org, you don't really need to trick the users, you can just grab your password. But without a cross-site scripting, you can even get simpler tricking people into giving you the password. So the social engineering hack, which is hard to do. So, I'm completely running out of time. But yes, cross-site scripting is very, very important. If you have no, if you have static pages, no login, no cookies, anything like that, don't worry too much about it. But if you do have any sort of authentication, you really have to worry about cross-site. So I had one little slide that I show you, just to give you an idea of what can actually be done. I have this form page here. It's a very simple form, font's a little small. This is all it is. The form has a type, text, and password, and submit button. So basically, I'm logging into somewhere, and the code behind it just checks to see if the password is foobar, or if it's Rasmus, password is foobar, and submit, it says welcome back Rasmus. So I've essentially logged into my site. Now, if I go to that site using this URL instead, so it's the same URL, grade on the UL. Now, people don't tend to look at the UL for the takeout. It looks exactly the same, right? The two forms, if you look at the code behind it, it's different. Because, well, suddenly it's people that I injected in the middle of my form action here, I injected the script source and code something. So I'm actually loading JavaScript from another site, from my own site. And then I'll hide the stuff that I wrote by putting the CAs or something in there. So I've injected some JavaScript into the Malware site around the in the query. Boom. The results are different because I now ran some JavaScript that changed stuff. And if we go back and look, we can go into tools. Page info. In the page info on the form, it's a little hard to see, but we simply have an ID, a password, and up at the top, it means that method post form action. Form action points to us.com/info.php. Now, I did this by writing a little bit of, so this was the actual injection. Once we decode this, we get the script source equals blah, 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 slash script, and let's hand it off that particular form tag. So, my remote JavaScript did this. I went through, and I added another load event. So you can go through, and just like you can add an on-load handler in your document body, you can add it anywhere in the script. Anywhere you can inject JavaScript, you can add an on-load handler. So window.onload equals function, old on-load func. So you still call the old one, then I call my function that I passed in, and I'm passing in a function called a. But here's my function, .conform0action equal. So I'm changing the action of the first form on the page. Once you can get in and get an onload handler, onload gets triggered when the entire document has been loaded, which means I have the whole DOM tree. Once I have the whole DOM tree, I can modify anything in that DOM tree. Right? So I can modify any form action. So now suddenly, when I go in, I have basically, if this was the Yahoo login page, it's the Yahoo login page. It looks exactly the same. It's the Yahoo.com URL. Everything is right. Right? All the cookies, everything is there, so it looks exactly like it. But except when I hit submit, it actually goes somewhere else off of my site. And I don't have to make it obvious. I can simply have invisibly log the person in. So you can think that, hey, every time I log in, everything works. I'm logging into Yahoo. I see my Yahoo stuff. You don't know that in between the login page and the normal page you get, it actually made a round trip. You have no idea. The only way to prevent something like this, the site that you visit regularly, is to never, never, ever click on a link. Because unless you investigate every single link and you look at what that link is, does this link have extra stuff in it? And those sites out there have all kinds of crap in the URL. You have no idea if some of the crap in the URL is a cross-site scripting attack. So for your bank account, for example, never ever click on the link to your bank account. Always type it in the URL or use a bookmark that you created yourself. Never, never, never click on the link. Like in an email that says, hey, your latest balance is under the bank. Never click on that. Don't even use the same browser. I don't use the same browser for so the general browser and for any sort of important stuff. I use Firefox for general browser, and I use Safari for anything personal. I simply don't trust websites to not have open. There's nothing you can really do about that. Right? I'm too lazy to investigate every single link before I click on it. And I know it's depressing that the web is basically broken. You can't click on links. What the hell is the web? The web is all about links, right? From a security perspective, you cannot click on links. And it's a problem. And you don't want to be the site that has the problem, but from the general server, there's nothing else you can really do about it. Other than completely separate your browser and provider. Right, the things you can do, stolen cookies, intercept the post request, so I showed you, all sorts of constant injection, visible requests, backend requests, buy more things, send stuff to this address, transfer stuff, money to this account, to this account. Anything you can do on a website, you can do it on the JavaScript script. One second. I am out of time. Okay, my last slide. This is one of the attempts we're doing in PHP. This is what I did for Yahoo. I put a data firewall up in front of all input from the users into the Yahoo. Just like a network firewall, block everything but poke just a few holes, they want to let certain things through firewall. This is what I do for data now. So this data firewall turns everything into very simple ASCII, A through Z, 0 through 9, spaces, basically very, very simple stuff. If you want anything other than that, you have to specifically go and poke a hole in the data firewall by saying, I want the raw data for this particular variable, or I want URL, I want this stuff passed through a URL filter, an email filter, whatever. You have to specifically say what kind of data you want. But by default, everything is filtered out. So the applications will mostly still work because most of the text gets through, and the script was encoded, so it gets through. The name is O. Henry. Sorry, the name is now O and to be Henry. Right? So that's what that is. It's magic code gone nuts. And I know people hate magic code, but short of doing this data firewall, I don't see how we solve it. People are not filtering their input correctly, and it certainly solves things for Yahoo. So Yahoo implementation is now public. It's not the same implementation, but there's a version now in PHP 5.2 called Filter. It's available in Heckler as well for older, so to any PHP 5 now, you can use Filter. And you can go and make this slide. One of the things you can do is you can set up sort of this array of your arguments that you're expecting for your application, and you can up front say what filters you want to apply to each one. You can say, I want my product ID passed through this filter, component passed through this filter. You put ranges on numbers. You basically consistently define all of user inputs, so everything has to pass those through in order to get through. And anything that doesn't match those will have to get a really strict filter that filters out everything else. So have a look at that as one approach to doing it. If you're running untrusted code on a server, you don't want to audit every line of code, putting a strict filter out in front of it is a good way of making sure that that code that you don't trust very much is constrained. You can't do that in the sandwich. You can't introduce cross-site scripting holes onto your code if you like. If you take some random blogging package, you put it on your .com site, for example, you don't want that blogging package to be a way of introducing cross-site scripting into your whole corpus environment. So, have a look at filter. That's our idea for helping some of these cross-site scripting issues. I'll be around. And the slides are this URL at the top here, ATC at Techco, the YGN stuff, some of the API that shows geocoding and others, as well as the Yahoo. And filter, you can read about http://filter. Thank you. Any quick questions? I know I ran a bit over. No questions. Like I said, I'll be around. I'll be hanging out up in the pavilion. So if you have stuff, if you want me to check your site, setting cross-site certification, I can do that as well. I have a scanner that does it really, really fast. It takes me a lot of minutes to check the site.